Now that heart is beating fast, and that's the rhythm I can dance to. I'm mighty glad I've got a chance to that one big heart that's beating fast. Tomorrow morning, let it rain. Tomorrow morning, let it pour. Tonight, we're in the groove together. Ain't gonna worry about stormy weather. Gonna kick old trouble out the door. Beat out old trouble and drunk. Trouble on the drum, beat out old trouble on the drum, and kick old trouble out the door. Beat me that rhythm on the drum, beat me that rhythm on the drum, beat me that rhythm on the drum, and kick old trouble out the door. Kick him out the door, kick him out the door, kick him out the door, kick him out the
Well, 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 we've got a fancy new guest today who knows everything about something. Now, how do you pronounce your name? Because I'll stuff it up as usual.
Yeah. My name's Jan van Delfsen. In Dutch it was Jan van Delfsen, but Jan van Delfsen in English usually. Used to call me John because no one could say Jan. They used to call me Jan. So my cousins still call me John.
Right.
But it's Jan, that's my legal name.
Right. And where were you born?
In the Netherlands, in Eindhoven.
What year?
1945.
45, that makes you an octogenarian.
Yep, turned 80 last year.
Well, congratulations on that. Did you get your OBE?
I saw you had some notable people in the this program in the past, and I'm humbled.
Well, no, an OBE, that's over bloody 80.
Yeah, I got that.
You got that?
Yeah, got that.
I mean, I'm sure somebody would have sent you a card with over bloody 80 on it. Yeah, well, that's great. So how old were you when you came to Australia?
Five.
You got any memories of Holland?
Yeah. Just funny things that kids remember, you know. But things they tell you about yourself, I don't remember them.
No. Could you tell us one thing you remember?
Being in a pram and looking up and outside a shop waiting for mum and looking up and seeing at a T intersection, seeing tanks rolling by across the T intersection. Yeah.
Right.
Army tanks. That's something I remembered.
Right.
Also remembered some dreams.
Right.
Yeah.
Obviously your parents survived World War II, did they?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Scary. The Allied bombing, German-occupied Allied bombing, they were lucky to be alive because they were caught in the street with lots of bombs and shrapnel, and mum went down and hit the deck and dad kept cycling with my sister on board.
Right.
You know, and they never saw each other for several days.
Right.
You know, a scary time.
So apart from your sister, do you have any other siblings?
No, she's passed on.
Your sister. Yeah. So any reason they decided to come to Australia?
My dad always had itchy feet. He wanted to go to America. He's got a sister up there, a couple of sisters, and mum wouldn't go anywhere. And he came to Australia because Europe was a mess. He said, two world wars, I've had enough of Europe, let's spark out somewhere. Yeah. And he managed to talk all of mum's family into coming.
Right.
We were all going to, because mum didn't want to come, leave her family.
Right.
She's a very social and connected person. Mm. So they were all going to come. After a couple of years, half of them changed their mind, reneged, I suppose.
Went back.
But it was really good. My dad, that's a really good thing. Dad was prepared to not, you know, take mum seriously.
Right.
Nothing worse than being on your own in a strange country.
Well, there's nothing
worse. And
a man
goes off to work and the kids are at school and you're on your own.
Yeah. So where did you end up? Was it one of the major cities or...?
We were scheduled to land in Melbourne. Turned off. We actually got off the ship at Sydney. In a camp in Bathurst and then in Broadmeadows. And then Dad got a job in Geelong with a firm he worked with all his life after that, John Peeman in Geelong. And we lived on the building site. That was our first house in Australia.
What do you mean you lived on a building
site? Well, it was just three rooms and three families on concrete floor and just a shack.
Yeah.
And it was all communal. It was communal eating. We had a huge hangar type thing where the men used, Dutch guys, they used to... get fed there, and we had a little room and it was not very good while my dad was building commission homes.
Right.
And after he finished his first couple of houses, he said, "My son's not going to die of pneumonia while I've built a perfectly good house." And he completely ignored all the paperwork, just moved us into the house he'd built.
Right, right.
And we lived there until he built his own house about 6-7 years later.
Right, right. Yeah. So what was it like the first day you went to primary school? You'd have no word of English.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, faux pas and embarrassments. Yeah. I remember saying to kids in Bathurst as preschool, "Oh, look, there's a hose. I've seen a snake."
Yeah.
And the Dutch word for snake and hose are the same thing.
Right.
So I thought I knew something.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
And then I come to Australia and Mum said, "Where's your towel?" And I said, "Oh, I left it at the beach." And she said, "Go and tell your principal." And I said, "Well, what do you call it?" And she told me, and I went up to the principal's office, and the principal and the vice principal were there.
Yeah.
And I said, "Oh, Mum tells me, I've got to tell you, I've lost my tail."
Right.
And both the principal and the vice principal laughed their heads off. That is so embarrassing for a little grade one kid.
Yeah.
So it's that type of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so cultural differences.
Yeah. So how'd you get, what primary school did you go to?
I went to North Geelong State School. Doesn't exist anymore.
No.
And then at grade four, we went into Norlane. Norlane was a growth area, and that school also doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
Norlane State School and Norlane High School. And when we built our own house, or Dad's dream home, we went to Newcombe, way away from the other side of town, and I went to Geelong High School, where
Geelong
I did most of my high school.
And what was Geelong High School like?
Oh, I went back to teach there later. Actually.
Yeah, well, tell us what it was like for when you're a student.
In my opinion, it was still the same. Relatively, I copped it, because I must have had my own foibles and nicknames from the teachers that embarrassing to repeat.
Right.
The late Mr. Van Delsen.
The late Mr. Van Delsen.
Yeah, yeah. And conservation of energy.
Right.
My chemistry teacher.
Conservation of energy.
Yeah, yeah. He was really into it. And it didn't matter what I did that was good. Like, I got a lot of runs in cricket when I picked up cricket and got good quickly.
Yeah.
A bit of luck. And he was always saying, "Oh, you didn't get another 100. Now, 13 overs, I got nearly 100. Didn't get 100. Like, always not acknowledging anything good. Do you know what I mean? So I didn't really like school in the early days because teacher, you don't know your tables, don't know your spelling. I was learning to read and write Dutch and English at the same time.
Were you doing Dutch schools here?
No. I had comics.
Comics.
My cousins lived with us.
Right.
Briefly.
Yeah.
And there was Dutch Donald Ducks.
Right.
And I used to, when they left, there was no one to read it to me.
No.
So I was sort of just, I learnt off comics, right? And we were reading John and Betty at school.
Right. Did you speak Dutch at home? Or?
Dutch at home. I mean, like you, Italian until you go to school, right?
That's right, yeah.
Well, it was a bit like that.
Yeah.
And it was good because the first 5 years and even the five more years of the people talking together in Dutch, I got quite a high level of Dutch, really, just by listening to the oldies.
Did you finish high school?
Yep, finished high school.
Year 12?
Yep.
What did that lead to?
What
was the chemistry teacher write? Conservation of
energy? I would have got really bad reports because, I wanted to go to uni and Monash had accepted me, but there was no way we could afford it. I said, "You can't afford to put me up at Monash." And later I told Dad that. He said, "Oh, we would have, but I self-censored and I didn't want to." So I went to the Gordon for 8 weeks doing architecture because Dad was a builder.
Right.
I thought that's where the way to go. And I got the very last, I swear it's the very last acceptance into Teachers College at Geelong.
Right.
So I had a weekend to decide and I became a teacher.
Right.
More by default.
How long was the training process for a teacher?
2 years.
2 years.
For primary teaching,
What was that like?
I thought it was quite creative, actually.
Right.
They were freer then than universities were for a while, I think.
Right, yeah.
I benefited from that. That one of the things I love that they taught was look at yourself, don't blame the kids, look at what you can do better.
Right.
And they instilled that in us, and that actually was very useful when I later came across, I thought, some terrible racism, people blaming the locals.
Yes.
And so forth, when it was really, you got to look at yourself. What can I do better?
What can you do better? So how old were you when you started teaching?
Well, 1960, 1967 was my first, it was grade five in, worked that one out, how old I was.
It's 23.
I had my first grade five in Footscray West.
Mm-hmm.
It was wonderful. But on the last day, I told them, next year I'm going into national service. I'd been deferred for 2 years.
Right.
And the girls, maybe boys too, they all cried and they cried. Now, I'd never thought I would go because I thought I had ailments, arthritic or whatever.
Yes, yes.
And I never gave it a thought. So I even waived my opportunity as an alien to get out of it because I thought, well, I'll never go. And then it came and I went into pucker and everything.
So you were inducted?
Yeah, but in the army.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Pucker Punyal was like, wow, how did I survive that? After lights out at 10 o'clock, every 10 o'clock, lights went out, and I had just got into a book by Sartre called Nausea.
Yep.
And I took it to the toilet because you could have lights on.
Yeah.
And I was reading this book, trying to keep myself not be taken over by being broken, you know.
Yes, yes.
They try to break you.
Yeah.
And so then I wrote letters, and my sister and my cousin said, for God's sake, don't write like this to your mum and dad because they'll freak. I was in the image of what Sartre was writing.
Oh, right, yes, you know, yes.
Amazing existential language, experiential.
Yeah.
And I was writing things like, you know, suddenly there's a, you know, let me out sort of thing, like Kafkaesque.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and Sartre had expressions that I've always remembered, like a fat maggot in my hand.
Yeah, but what drew you to this book?
Some uni students who were going to uni on the holidays before I went in, some young, very nice ladies, were reading ready for their first year.
Right.
Right. And they told me André Gide, Sartre, Nausea, and I got these books.
Right.
I said, well, I'll see what that's on about.
And this is at Pucker Punyal?
No, this is before I went in the army.
Right.
I took a book with me to Pucker Punyal.
Punyal,
And the corporal really, really had, the corporal, Kennedy, really had it in for me.
Right.
Because I was a teacher. A lot of us were teachers, but he really disliked me more, reckoned I was out of step all the time, which wasn't true. And the problem was I had been asked, couldn't I teach him, because he had to up his language level.
Yes.
He had to up his, so they picked me to teach him.
Oh.
Right?
Yes.
So he was in charge of me,
made
me do push-ups because I wouldn't be, I'd be out of step or whatever, everything he claimed that wasn't true.
Yeah.
And I had to do push-ups. I never begged, I always did it.
Yeah.
But I reckon it was ultimately because he was a very sad guy from school who hated school, and they were forcing me as a teacher on him, which wasn't a good idea. But I, you know, that's what some people go through in bastardization in the army.
Right. So this was 67, did you say?
Oh, army 68, 69, 70.
So right in the height of the Vietnam War.
Yeah, right in the Vietnam War. So, and I didn't want to go to Vietnam.
So what happened?
Well, I was very, very lucky because there were these people going for interviews and they all turned out to be teachers from Pucker, you know, our group.
Yes.
Our between 10 teachers.
Yeah.
They were all going to these interviews. I said, what's going on? Oh, never you mind. And my mate and I, who'd both been at Geelong Teachers College, Malcolm, and we went up to the boss and said, hey, how come they're all getting interviewed? We're teachers too. Why aren't I interviewed? Yeah. So he made us come back from leave.
Yes.
And of all the people who got the job, he and I got it, right? We're the only two of all the people. They wouldn't tell us what the... And it was teaching in Papua New Guinea, teaching soldiers in Papua New Guinea. And it's the best thing that could have happened to me because I got involved with local people and saw race relations at first hand.
So what did you... It's fascinating, this going to Papua New Guinea in 69, 70?
It started a bit earlier, before me.
Yes.
The year before, I think. I was there 68, 69.
Right. Where were you?
I was at WeWAC and I spent 3 months at Wanamo.
Right.
Right near the border with West Papua. And that's when the rebellion started. It was an amazing experience. I met refugees who came across. This is in this early, back in 68, I'd say. I was at Wanamo at the start of 69. The guy gave me a walking stick because they'd escaped from the Indonesian troops. There were thousands of troops across the border.
Right.
That was called Hollandia, where it was a university city.
Yes.
And they'd had an insurrection. They protested. They just said, we don't want the Indonesian taking this country.
Right.
And they'd walked across the border. And I was just having my Saturday off. And I was there and I saw these guys in the refugee camp right on the border. And they wanted English. They wanted, can you get me some English books? We're now on the English side and all that stuff. But subtly, the parson, the chaplain, told me I wouldn't talk to them, I wouldn't blah, blah, blah. They thought, because I could speak the same language as these people,
right.
They thought Australia is like training people to go back and fight or something like that, because I'm in the propaganda corps, right? Education corps.
That's right, yeah.
So that was a really, and the eye-opener was the people in the town and everywhere, everyone was always blaming the Papua New Guineans for anything that went wrong. And I remembered my teaching experience. You look at yourself. What are you doing? What's wrong? What doesn't he get? You know, why not? What can you change?
Yeah.
But I felt, I used to first hang out with the white people because that's where we were white people going there. And in the sergeant's mess, and I was a sergeant, and then I gradually ended up best friends with all the Papua New Guineans.
Yeah, yeah.
I just got gradually alienated because I didn't like their attitudes, really. And that was an eye-opener. Didn't know about racism before that.
You mentioned the sergeant's mess, which brought back a memory. In 1971, I was a CMF part-time civilian cleaner when I was doing medical school. And I had to clean the soldier's mess, the sergeant's mess, and the officer's mess. That was my job. And I always knew that you could never steal any alcohol from the sergeant's mess because they knew exactly. But with the officer's mess, you could actually rub out the line on the on the alcohol bottle and have a drink and change, and they didn't care.
I had trouble in Wanamo because I was in charge of the sergeant's mess, ordering and everything.
Yeah.
And there was a guy who was already there, who an old hand, and he'd been messing with everything. Yeah. And I had to say, "You've fix this up financially, or I'm going to the boss." And one of the things that happened in the army there, locals in town were often asking me, "Now you've got Captain Dero, local person, he's your boss. How can you cope with that?" I thought, I don't know, it just seems
he's your boss.
Normal, he's my boss. He tells me what to do.
Yeah.
They're trying to make the army ready for Papua New Guinea for independence and all that. But that getting that sort of question all the time really kind of opened my eyes a bit.
Right.
Yeah. If we didn't have independence for Papua New Guinea then, it might never have happened because people don't like letting go of their colonies.
No, they don't.
And you wonder why they even had them.
Yeah. So when did you come back? When were you demobbed, as they
say? The army was good in the sense I had a lot of good experiences like that, but also when I got back, the Australian government gave you a scholarship and housing, whatever. So I took the 1 year full-time study and I went to Monash.
Monash.
And that was where really my view of the world really changed, because I did really well with my studies for three terms. It was in terms in those days.
Mm.
And then a guy called Scotty came up to me and said, "Oh, I got this position and I can't keep doing it. I've got to study. Can you take it?" So I took on a chairperson of education committee of the Students Association.
Right.
And then I got involved in student politics and interacting with people and listening to what they had to say, I realised that I'd been completely led astray by our humble Geelong media.
Yeah.
That's now Murdoch, Geelong Advertiser. No one had any idea that there was any case about fighting colonialism, you know. No one ever thought about that. So here I was learning a completely different view of the world with facts that the mainstream media was holding away.
Right.
Yeah, and then you become...
So were you part of the student newspaper?
No, I wasn't on the student newspaper. No. And some articles that I wrote that were, I thought, really, really important got lost. Right. So,
bit of censorship. Yeah.
You know, I don't know what happened. Because, for instance, in 71, we were demonstrating against the Springboks tour.
That's right.
Right? And I was seen as some sort of leader, so... a big man.
Yep.
So I ended up with three flares.
Yep.
Right. And I already tried to get on the ground and got whacked on the head and managed to get away from being grabbed. There's a whole lot of people on the fence. And then these women gave me these flares and I thought, I have to throw them.
Right.
And I ended up throwing the flares after watching how the other guys got caught by the police and making sure I didn't get caught.
Right.
So I threw as far as I could like they did, but I managed to avoid getting caught. Largely by cheering with the crowd.
Cheering with the crowd.
The other guys got caught because they looked they looked obvious.
They looked obvious, yeah.
You know, so I cheered with the crowd.
You fit it in.
And then I wrote an article about a guy from New Guinea. Remember I said I was in New Guinea?
Yes, right?
Well, there was a guy. I said, Corporal Thomas, what are you doing here? Yeah. They had appointed a black guy from New Guinea who I knew really well because he was across the road from the education centre where I was working a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And we used to have good conversation. He was in signals, and he went. He said, "I'm at Watsonia doing a course, for signals." And he said, "We've been volunteered, quote unquote, volunteered." And obviously, his mates, army mates, were coming around, hanging around. I thought, "Oh, they're wondering what I'm doing because I had a lot of afro hair, big afro hair,
and
I would look like a radical."
Yep.
Don't think I had beads around my neck, but I looked like a radical.
Yeah.
And he said, "Yeah, we were volunteered." And I thought it was shameful that these people, the union had gone on strike. They wouldn't hand out stuff.
Right.
It was shameful that the authorities had given this New Guinea guy, who clearly wasn't on side with the protest, not the protest, with the match going ahead.
Yes.
Because we were saying these Africans aren't getting a fair share in sport. They weren't getting selected because they're getting no money for sport. They're not getting selected.
Yep.
So it was the first steps in fighting against apartheid, really.
Right, right.
So I wrote about this guy. What he told me was all those guys around the fence, they're all army volunteers. Now, all the radicals were telling me, they're Nazis.
Right.
Maybe there were one or two Nazis, but the whole fence was basically people who were volunteers, which I knew because I knew how easy I could volunteer. If I was in the army on the weekend and they said, we need O blood group.
Yep.
I'd just say, all right, guys, come on, O blood group. Who hasn't got O blood? Those who didn't have O blood group would fall out.
Yep.
I'd say, all you guys, who's not going to go and volunteer to the blood, give blood to the hospital? And no one would drop out. If you do it the right way, they'd all go.
Yeah.
So I know how volunteering went. And so I wrote this article about how I knew this guy really well, and he told me what he told me. It never went in the print.
And then
I had second thoughts, will I pursue this? And I thought, well, I might get him into trouble.
Right.
I pulled back. But it's interesting to note that was army being used.
That's right.
Which people don't know. And in the stand above me, they were watching all this, was the governor. Yep. He was there. He was applauding a lot of the things the police were doing. And after the demonstrations were more or less over, the match was finished, there were these police on horseback, and they were crushing the crowd that couldn't get out because there's a narrow opening to get out. Mm. They were crushing them against a high wire fence. People were climbing up trying to and it was ridiculous. It was like hitting them and pushing them and stuff. And it was ridiculous. And you become, like with the Vietnam War, you become radicalised, just seeing what lengths the state will go to try to keep control and stop dissent.
Remember the old Chicago saying, nothing radicalises like a pig in the park.
Yeah,
68 Chicago Democrat Convention. Yeah. So, what year did you finish university?
Well, I took a bit longer because
that doesn't matter. You were doing things.
Yeah. I was doing stuff, and I was doing a lot of stuff in education and all that, and got elected. AUS was strong on campus, and I was there, the AUS connection through my education chairperson role. And so eventually I got elected. After AUS brought Ivan Illich out in 71, 72, and I got really involved. I went to that, and so I got elected to being EVP for AUS.
Could you explain to people what EVP is?
Education Vice President. The Vice President who's in charge of education.
Right.
So I was to talk to students, professors, promote educational issues and all that. Ivan Illich was the person I was promoting.
Yeah.
Right. But I was also into a whole lot of Paula Ferreri, a lot of radical education.
At that stage,
And the people that I was involved with, we did things like go to Nimbin, and the people I took to Nimbin back in 73, when I was in a combi with a bunch of young school dropouts who were printing, they were Walker Press.
Walker Press.
Jack Gilding.
The famous Walker Press.
Walker Press. Yeah. Now, I'll get to how long it took me, because of all this, it took me longer to get through uni.
Yeah.
But Walker Press took two big printing presses, and I drove the combi, because no one else would. They were all underage, etc.
Yeah.
And Sue Hawke and Jack Gilding's were item at the time. And they and halfway there, on three quarters of the way there, the broke down.
Right.
So by the time I got there, yeah, well, I walked straight into a riot.
Right.
There was three guys got arrested.
Yeah.
Three, some say four. Mm. And the crowd, thousands came, and I got involved in the arguments about what to do with the police. So,
yeah, yeah.
At the time, the only office bearer who was there. So eventually I finished and other things happened. I was probably the first field officer. I turned the job into not a bureaucrat thing.
Mm-hmm.
I was promoting the idea of how a bureaucrat shouldn't be bureaucratic by taking on everyone's wishes, but yep. throwing it back at them to do it.
Right.
That was the yep. way I got elected, really, because yep. I was running workshops to help people figure, if you're a bureaucrat, get the people with ideas to follow up their own ideas and support them.
Yep.
And so I had some workshops like that. But in the end, they turned that whole idea of the field officer into a regional-based, like each state the next year then became... They had their own field officers.
So how were you surviving?
Well, when I was with AUS, that was a full-time job.
Oh, right.
And I was getting an allowance. Right. I had a huge travel allowance. Mm. I had 52 campuses to cover. I got nowhere near that.
No.
And I used to stay with the students.
Yeah.
It was exciting but very emotionally draining. You'd go and stay with someone for three nights, then you never see them again.
Mm.
I never recommend that.
Were you involved in the, I think it was the Day of Anger in Canberra in 71? Because campuses from all over.
Yeah.
Because I remember I was involved in that. I was 18 or 19, and campuses from all over Australia came to Canberra.
I did not go to Canberra in 71. No.
No.
The thing that I really loved about Nimbin and these Walker Press people that were going there with the printing press was they were looking at alternative ways of doing things.
Right.
It wasn't like Woodstock. It was more like alternative culture, how to do things differently.
Yep.
And it was a really wide range of types of people. So when this place, Walker Press, was started, it was a lot of different people. They weren't all clearly like, they weren't all anarcho-communists or anarchists.
No. Yep.
They were people from all different backgrounds. There were Maoists and Trots and anarchists.
Yep.
And people who didn't want any label.
No,
right?
They
never had accepted any label.
Now you kind of pointed to the back window.
Yeah.
Why did you point to the back window here? What do you mean? Walker Press. Did Walker Press start off here at 21 Smith Street, did they?
Yeah, Walker Press was actually further north in Brunt, you know, a little bit away from here.
Yeah.
They got going first in AUS building, then they found their own little place to rent, and then they everyone got together, and some two professors, Feith and Peter Fensham from Monash, put some backing behind it, and they bought this place. They went to the bank. They put the collar and tie on. It was high school dropouts, right?
Yeah.
And they went to the bank, and they got the money to buy these two buildings here.
Yeah.
And then with volunteer work, they
They got the money to buy 21 Smith Street.
Yeah, 2123 it was.
And 2123.
This is 23. 23 is on one. 21's near a Victoria Parade.
Right.
23. So it's all called 21. That's easy.
Yeah.
Even then it was called 21.
So how are you involved in those early days?
Well, I was best friends at uni. Lyndon Shea was a guy who was very active here later. But when I was active at Monash, Lyndon was doing his, dip ed.
Dip ed, yeah.
And he worked with me on some campaigns and things. And so we were like really good. And he, in fact, helped me get elected to AUS.
Right.
They were all a bit like compatible with the Illich type de-schooling mentality.
Yep.
You know, these dropouts from high school
who
preferred to be hands-on. Jack, who was one of the key people who started at Jack Gilding, one of the favourite cartoons that he used to have up was of an ordinary little guy fixing a push bike, a flat tire or something, and the one waiting on the side was Superman.
Oh, right.
So Superman's tire was being fixed by, and Jack Gilding was identifying with the practicality of this guy fixing the bike.
Right.
And I thought, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle, maybe?
Yes.
All that sort of stuff, really hands-on thing.
Mm.
And that's the sort of thing that started this place, like volunteers.
What year was it purchased, do you remember? 79, 80?
No. No, 3CR was 77, wasn't it? Yeah. It was sort of parallel to 3CR in Collingwood.
So you bought about 77.
Yeah, because I moved in 78.
So you moved in here, 21
Smith Street. In 78, yeah.
So you lived...
And I became a director with part of that group.
Well, so what was the business structure of this? How did it work?
They took a company off the shelves,
yep.
San Giuliano.
Yep.
Just coincidentally.
$2 company.
Yeah.
$2
yeah.
company,
and,
yeah.
And internally, somehow, all the people who paid rent got it back as shares.
Right. So you were upstairs, you were paying rent.
Yeah, I was paying rent and I was organising. We all took it in turns, who was going to bank the rent and all that. And then the office workers like Lyndon doing stuff about education subscription service that was compatible with Ivan Illich, like how to print out what people say they want. It predated what computers make easy.
Yeah.
Right. There were other people elsewhere doing things like Learning Exchange, John Burke and Kerry.
Yes, they was here at 21 Smith Street.
No. But we were an open book. There were other things that were happening at the time. It was a whole movement of radical education.
What was happening here? What was happening here?
Lyndon and Caroline Gurbich were producing education subscription service, still have the magazines, and they were summarising anything that came out of alternative education related. Mm-hmm. And then people would subscribe and say, I want that copy, and they would multiple copy it, print it with Walker Press, and send it out to people. And also then he was a key person. They got funding from church, the Uniting Church sometimes, and others. And he also did stuff on CARE, care, and that was initially about the South African issue, about anti-apartheid.
Right. So what type of groups were using 21 Smith Street?
CARE then morphed more towards, largely through Lyndon, towards Aboriginal rights and Aboriginal land rights, and a group called CAMAL, CAMAL, Campaign Against Mining Aboriginal Land, was based here. It was amazing stuff. They printed out some booklet, for instance, for the people up north who had been spun a yarn by the companies. The booklet would show how many football fields their open cut would be.
Right.
And, like, they'll go, oh, my God, companies weren't telling us this. So it was very important service. John Roberts became Jan Roberts and produced the book. Jan was around here for a bit.
Jan Roberts produced the book Jack of Cape Grim in 1988 as a bicentenary. Oh. And that's what got me started on the Tanaminiwai and Mulbohina journey to have this monument created in 2016. Right. So Jan Roberts, I never met her, but I got a call about 8 years ago. This person rang me and said, oh, did you know Jan Roberts? I said, no. But she said, you're involved in this group. And I said, yeah. She said, look, I've got all her books here. I can't stand them sitting in my corridor. Yeah. Come and pick them up. So I have. I haven't taken them out of the boxes yet, so I will one day.
So Jan was travelling around up north and that. And
then she was the first transsexual to actually have surgery in Victoria.
Right. So that was all kind of new to us, and we learned to accept that. Bless them. What she wants.
Yeah.
But then another group that finally came here was East Timor, John Tarrant. They probably couldn't pay the rent just down the road.
Right.
And they made their postal address here.
Yeah.
A whole lot of groups like that were kind of based here.
So what, people were living upstairs and groups were using downstairs?
Mostly we lived upstairs, I think. I don't think anyone lived downstairs.
How many people do you think lived upstairs?
We had six.
Six?
Yeah, even when there were couples, might have been seven.
Right.
And I was kind of like, after they had an initial group that fell apart because they couldn't agree they had disagreements.
Mm-hmm.
And then they asked Lyndon and Caroline asked me, could I get a group together? And we had people paying rent upstairs.
Right.
Kind of quite cohesive, quite good, but amazing when you think that the one guy was a Maoist and later when he was working against AUS, I found that a bit hard. Peter Costello would turn up on a Sunday afternoon and meet with Mike and they'd talk about what they were going to do to AUS.
Yes.
Right? So you had to put up with that. Yeah, and how could you live with people when you that hurt me.
Yeah.
And there were others. There was, what's her name? There was a woman who's passed on this. She was also president of AUS for a while before Gillard. There was a lot of, even Gary Foley came here sometimes.
Right.
He was always challenging me to a game of chess, and
right.
I never took it up because I was hopeless at chess. I should have taken it up.
Should have taken it up.
Yeah.
Well, at least you and Gary are still alive.
Yeah. It's good to see Gary going on. Yeah,
both of you are still going, which is excellent. Yeah. So how many years did you spend here?
4.5 years I lived here. I was involved with the idea of the project and what it was all about.
Right.
I'd say from the time of 72 when Illich went to start on about Illich, and I got elected and all that to promote that idea.
Mm.
Very hard to do. Mm. What are we doing? Paying for you? What are you doing if you're a university? And basically the idea was Illich really said the first thing you do when you leave home is you sit in a seat, the teacher is the teacher, and you might forget all the lessons, but you remember that first thing, and that is someone up front, you've got to learn learning through that person.
Right.
And completely changes how you have been learning in the first 5 years. And that was one of the things he used to say that grabbed me, because I was kind of a curious kid. I used to love observing and learning.
Mm.
So here we are. He made a good point. Another thing was the people that don't do well in the meritocratic hierarchy, those who aren't scoring well, they're marked for life sometimes. It's a very bad system for the people who aren't the winners.
Yeah.
And sometimes one...
It was an interesting little section of Smith Street up here because you had the Collingwood Free Stall at 42 Smith. Do you have any contact with the Collingwood Free Stall?
I'm not sure of that name.
No. A bit earlier. They were 71 to about 73, and they were 42 Smith Street across the road. They actually rented that place, and it was basically a exchange. You brought things and you took things. There was no money involved. And they were trying to set up an alternative economic system. But I'm just saying that's just, you know, ten houses down the road from 21,
We used to go down the road to Friends of the Earth and get our gear, and we'd take it in turns shopping at the Vic Market and buy bulk meat and stuff.
Yeah.
It was a good communal experience.
Right.
But then all good things end, and particularly because we're all into deinstitutionalisation, when it's over. You say, well, let's all go. We're going our own way. And then I can't remember how the connection happened with 3CR, but the whole place then became 3CR.
So were you involved in that transition?
No, I wasn't.
No. So you'd been kicked out before then.
I was a director.
Yeah.
And I moved out around the time that happened.
Right. And so did you...
I went to Geelong.
Did you maintain any contact with 3CR?
Not 3CR, no, but the people. Lyndon became our best man from my wedding.
Uh-huh. When was that? When was your wedding?
25 years ago, nearly.
24 years ago.
Yeah.
You're still married?
Yeah.
Oh, any kids?
No kids, but too old. Both of us too old. And we both married for the first time. And guess what?
Get what?
All the international criticisms I've had about American foreign policy, I married an American.
Did you?
I can't believe that. My sister said, I can't believe it. She said... Then she realised, well, they're kindred spirits, they'll be all right.
We
met in Germany. I wasn't going to go to the US. I've been now a few times.
Yeah. So after you left here, you went what? You went overseas? You got married? You went overseas?
At some point, I started studying again. I went back to, I loved Monash, and I went back with the education department pushing me, like they wanted learning of languages. So I did a Japanese major, and then I added a German major. And in my German major, I went to Germany.
Mm-hmm.
I had to pick somewhere to go for a few months, and that's where I met my wife. So
what year was that?
The start of 2002. Oh, right. She was looking over her shoulder because of 9/11.
Yep.
She was there when all that happened.
Yep.
And she was, you could spot her as American. They were all talking German. Yeah. I spotted her straight away as American. She's American.
Right.
You know, there's something.
There's something. You had something in common. You both spoke English.
I got my two majors in languages and some other subjects. So it was good because it showed me the contrast between the first degree I got, which was mainly majored in social sciences, dropped the sciences, and then it was going backwards.
Yeah.
And less money in it. And back in the 2000, around that time, it was definitely a lot backwards. Their marking was easier, in my opinion. Well, it's hard to judge because you're more conscientious as an older person.
Yeah.
You know, as a younger person, I would be into alternative stuff I was doing all the time. I don't know how much time I spent.
Well, I think the difference is, and I is the difference is we didn't have continuous assessment. You could fart around. And you turn up for your exam. And if you passed, you pass. And if you failed, you fail. But I my belief is that once continuous assessment was introduced to the universities, that radical activity dropped off markedly because people were basically nose to the grindstone all the time.
Well, I was living here in 68 when I did my last subject. I turned up on the first day, got the papers about the subject, so his philosophy second year subject, and I went back for the exam. I didn't attend any classes, and I got a HD.
That's the way it works.
And I attended no classes. I just had to, you know,
do it.
And that got my first degree out of the way, finally, after 9 years. It gave me an extension. and this other one, later on, I went when I was teaching again, I was doing English as an alternative language and at Melbourne Uni. And one exam they gave me, afterwards I said to the guy, and I did really well, I said to the guy, thank you for just once off they tried using an exam. Mm. Just when I was there, I loved it. I just had to turn up and do the exam. I did really well. He said, you're 300 people, you're in the top three. Well, I knew all that stuff about, you know, that they were doing because I'd already done it in linguistics
That's right.
At the other place. But it was such a relief that I could just sit an exam, run it off, and be done with.
I reckon that with the introduction of AI into the, you know, tertiary education sector, that they're going to have to go back to exams. They can't continue for continuous assessment because you know, you're not learning anything.
Yeah. China bit the bullet much quicker than anyone else,
right?
And they reintroduced non-computer stuff, you know, in schools and that quicker,
right?
And we really should. The worst thing with little kids is they start doing copy and paste and make a really nice document, but they didn't create anything.
No,
and they look like they looks good,
and they don't actually understand what
they don't know what they're doing. No. It's a disaster. Yeah. So you do need literacy in computers and all that. But what we were doing was too much. Like illusions, you know.
Yeah.
Kids aren't learning.
They're not learning in tertiary institutions. I'm quite concerned because, you know, I did medicine. I'm still doing medicine 50 years later, and that's a practical type of job. And I see a lot of people coming out of medical schools these days. They just don't have they've got the knowledge, but not the skills, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Maybe we're just two old bastards talking about the good old days.
I also got high marks for a submitted one. A course was done entirely by, I did semantics as one of my units.
Right.
And just following the teacher's book, big fat book.
Yeah.
And just had to answer his assignments.
Yeah.
And I was just doing it. And I got a really good mark. I was just doing it.
Yeah.
So, really? I just did it. Other people must have given up or what? I don't know. But so I don't mind assignments, but it doesn't give you any time to do anything else.
Mm.
And that's, I agree with you. Mm. That's one of the things that probably killed, as well as the funding structure.
That's right. Yeah.
Killed activism. Mm. But Monash was unique. I thought Monash was unique when I was around Melbourne Uni, even in those days. Monash was far more, it was like, because it's away from the city, you're kind of in an enclave in the community. And so, and a few radical lefties and on about Vietnam. And everyone was talking with everybody. There was there were no cliques. The cliques were really weak.
Yeah.
Whereas at Melbourne Uni, I thought there were cliques. So it's a local thing. Yeah. Everyone talked with everyone for that time.
In those days, the most exciting place at the university was the cafeteria.
Yeah. I spent a lot of time in the cafeteria talking to people.
You talk to people, you hatch plots, you do things, you organise protests. It was so much learning. Yeah.
That, you know, why they suppress that is because they're scared of too much critical thinking for society.
Right. Yeah.
So they don't want that. No, right? But education isn't meant to really open your eyes.
No.
It's you're meant to learn how to do what you have to do, the job that's now needed.
Yeah, fit in, a cog to fit in. So where have you been overseas?
I've been to Japan a couple of times with our local Hobson's Bay International Friendship Association.
And what does that entail? Tell us about the association.
Yeah, it runs exchange with a sister city. Anzhou is a city in just near, Toyota used to be near there, right? And in Altona, Toyota was based there. So they developed that relationship with Hobson's Bay.
Right.
And we have this little group that meets, and I became a chaperone once for help pick four students, and I've been involved ever since. So they would come here, chaperone with four students, and it was a fantastic, you know, live with each other. And it's the only way to see a place, to live in the place.
Mm.
None of this tourist stuff. I don't take with tourism at all.
No.
I think it's exploitative and it's superficial. Mm. Yeah. I love it. What I loved about being in New Guinea was I got to know these people.
Right. You were there for 2 years, that's right.
Yeah. And out in the villages and stuff.
Did you have any other experience like that overseas?
No, went back when I married and that around that time we went and visited relatives and my wife's old friends and that.
How did you feel about going to the States? Did it reinforce your prejudices, or did it open up your eyes?
I was preoccupied with who I was going to see.
Right.
And so it's hard to be objective. Where she was is a bit elite. I noticed there were a lot of black people in the shops running it, but they don't live there, that type of thing. Observed things like that. Friends of hers, fairly well off, didn't agree with her politically, and there were no blacks in the whole community.
Which state is this?
That was parts of New Jersey.
New Jersey. Yeah. Well, that's supposed to be a liberal state.
Yeah. But that's a pattern, you know. Here's this really friendly black woman in the shop nearby, near her house, and they live miles away.
Yeah.
You know, the system there, and built in racism, because, for instance, you get some blacks move into an eloquent white neighbourhood, and the people sell out, and the prices drop, so they never gain any wealth.
Right.
You know, this has sort of happened a lot, and so maybe it happens here too with Aboriginal people. I don't know, but that pattern is like people doing this, not realising they're being racist, not feeling racist, but I better sell before whatever, price drops.
Yeah.
And then the whole thing goes down and the black people never build up any wealth.
Mm. And you're saying you went back to Holland, did you?
Yeah.
What did you think of, how old were you?
After 50 years. 50 years. I had not been back.
Right.
You know, the old story, when I had money, I didn't have time. Yeah. When I had time, I didn't have any money.
Money, right.
Right. It was always like that.
Yeah.
Right. So I went back when I went and did this course, this German course.
Yeah.
So I got I actually picked the place closest to the Netherlands. Every weekend I went to see my cousins.
All right.
We never knew each other.
Right.
Because they were all little when we left.
Yeah.
And they treated me like a brother. They were fantastic. So, yeah, there's something about kin.
Yeah.
Mm, I didn't, you know, how deep can you get, really? But they look after you like you're a brother.
Right.
So that was good. And I've stayed with, the last time we went, we picked up on the one that I didn't see when I took off with my wife to be and rang him and said, I can't come. That was the only one I hadn't been to.
Yeah.
So when we went more recently, last year actually, we lived with them. Mm. I said, you're the people I didn't see 20 odd years ago, and they were wrapped, and it was right, they live right across the road from Van Gogh, where his dad was preaching and all that. There's a museum there, it was wonderful. So they were, so I've lived with all the rallies at some point on my mother's side. Hard to catch up with the others, a lot of them have passed.
That's what happens, isn't it? As you get older, people, you're going to funerals more than you go to weddings or christenings. You're
but I'm glad I
funerals.
Went to Australia.
Yeah, why?
Well,
well, you didn't go. Your father took you to Australia.
No, but I learned from my sister before she passed, before she died.
Yeah.
She said, oh, we went to Australia because of your health.
Yeah.
Really?
Your health?
Yeah, because I was really sickly.
Yeah.
Right?
What? Coughs, colds, that type
everything.
Of stuff?
Nose blocked, pale, lacking, all sorts of stuff. But Australia, in three years' time, they all those things had gone.
Yeah.
And I think part of it was the freedom.
Right.
Not just the sunshine, it was the freedom.
Right.
In the Netherlands, everything was controlled and small and tight.
Yep.
In Australia, I could do anything and turn up in the evening for the meal. That wasn't possible in the Netherlands.
So how are you filling in your time these days, now that you're an octogenarian?
Okay, yeah, we sing.
What do you mean you sing? Tell us about that.
We sing in a choir called Victoria Chorale.
Right.
Run by an Austrian guy who's now an Aussie.
Right.
And my wife is now in going to Austria right now from northern Italy and France, where she was in the heat wave. That I decided not to go.
Right.
We went last year, that's enough.
Yeah.
And so we sing, and we quite often perform in St. Paul's Cathedral on Saturday afternoons.
Right.
And so I do that, and I'm also active in the Uniting Church.
What position?
Currently, I'm secretary of Williamstown. Electra Street United Church.
How hard is it to get people to get involved in
hard.
It? Hard. It is, isn't it?
Hard. People come and go.
I noticed, because I used to live in the Black Rock area before my wife died, and I noticed I was driving past yesterday or the day before that the local Uniting Church has been sold in Black Rock. And I understand why, because my wife used to go occasionally and there'd be a congregation of 12 people.
Ah, you know? Yeah. No, we still have a healthy 30 to 45. Right. Sometimes it's reached 80.
Right.
And we have online people.
Right. And yeah. Do you have a rotating preacher or?
No, we have a regular preacher at the moment. We still have enough to keep that going.
Right. They live on the premises, do
no,
they?
No, no. They remove that. Is now part of the offices, the old manse, mm-hmm. and there's another building further away. Mm-hmm. The manse is now used for offices and other things. We have emergency relief,
right,
which is actually Anglicare, mm-hmm. but it's Williamstown Emergency Relief that uses the premises. We have lots of concerts, musical concerts, encouraging jazz festivals and all that stuff.
So you've been active and that's what keeps
you
alive.
I like to encourage the use of the place.
Yeah.
We have all sorts of things like that, and it's... Yeah, it's fun. I do PowerPoints for the church service. I just sort of back up
stuff.
But there's always things to do.
Right. Do you think your belief in religion, you've always had it, or if it gets stronger?
I was born in a church. Dad was a caretaker in the Netherlands.
Right.
And that place was pulled down. Everywhere where I've been in a church. They've been pulled down. Everywhere. Okay.
Except Hobson's Bay.
Or they've been sold at the last minute. The one we got married in Geelong. No, Hobson's, the one now, Williamstown, not yet for a while, I hope.
Right.
But it only takes a couple of key people to leave and no one steps up.
Yeah.
That's all it takes.
Mm.
But I don't see that happening. We're having a 150th anniversary in November
mm-hmm.
of the building.
Yeah.
It was an early, it's a very historic site.
Right.
It's cost a lot of money to keep people say, our church has got a lot of money. It costs a lot to maintain slate roofs and
all that stuff.
And the government won't let you do too much.
Are you on the historic register?
It makes it very difficult.
Yeah,
and so we had to fight to get solar panels on part of the buildings. That we won that fight with the local council. And we've got good people who will do those sorts of things. I quite enjoy it. It's fulfilling. I sometimes say, well, my cousins say, why do you believe in God? We agree on all this political stuff. Mm. How come you believe in God? None of my cousins, except one, there's one in the Uniting Church. Right. But almost all the others in the Netherlands, they're all humanists.
Yep.
And they can't understand why I believe in God.
Well, I'm asking, why do you believe in God?
Well, I was brought up a very rational and very, data-oriented.
Yep.
I was a good observer, good drawer as a little kid.
Yep.
Very good. So I'm very sort of scientific oriented, and I didn't have a sudden flash.
No.
It wasn't any sudden thing.
No.
It was somewhere around the time I finished with AUS,
mm-hmm.
around 74, there are a lot of little things happened that made me think, hey, there's more than what I can see and measure.
Right.
Right? And I had an event, for instance, when I was back in Geelong. The dog... And a pony met one day because they brought a pony into our place. We had a paddock. And they told me, the pony's going to have a birth at Christmas, about 3-4 weeks off. So that night I went to bed and the dog sleeps on my floor upstairs in the house. And about 1:30, 2 o'clock, I woke up. The dog is heaving, like he's doing a big long poop or something.
Yeah.
And I thought, what's that? You know, what's wrong, Joe? And then he finally stopped. And I said, well, now I'm awake. I'll go and have a look how the pony's going. I went about 150 metres to the back behind the box thorns. And there was the pony licking the skin off the baby that was born. Right? So it was like...
Excuse me.
A baby foal was born.
Oh, right.
While the dog was heaving.
Right. And I thought it was a human baby.
No. The baby, the foal, pardon the language.
Yeah.
And it was... Let's just give you one example of something that makes me realise, hey, what's happening between the dog and the pony, that the pony probably was heaving, pushing the baby foal out, but the dog, 150 metres behind two locked doors, one locked door, upstairs, was heaving like he was there,
like he
was doing it.
Yep.
And the dog never did that before, that dog that was here, he never did that before, never. He lived to 20 years of age, very unusual.
Mm.
And... little things like that. And another time I got in the car and I just drove aimlessly into the country from Geelong.
Mm.
I was visiting mum and dad. And I ended up in Moriac or Mount Moriac and pulled in and there were these 12 motorbikes lined up.
Right.
at some hall I'd never been to or knew nothing about.
Mm.
And I went out, and there was John Smith,
yeah,
God
right.
Squad, like preaching God Squad. To a bunch Lots of kids,
yeah.
teenagers.
Yeah.
And I thought, what made me come here? I just, you know, I didn't tell them about it. I never told them that that happened. They would have said, God called you. I didn't go on about it. I never talked much about it. But then my sister needed someone to look after her, and she lived right near where God Squad was in Bayswater. And so I went there for a couple of years. I spent time with John Smith's Bible studies and stuff. And that kind of turned me back towards, after uni, turned me back towards thinking, I think there's more than meets the eye in the world.
Makes sense, yeah.
You know, and so I really do believe in God. Right.
Fair enough. Yeah. Now, just in the last few minutes, I just want to ask you a few questions about, you hadn't walked into this building since 1982. Is that correct?
Maybe at the front. I didn't go through the building ever.
No.
A while ago, I might have popped in.
Well, tell us what you've noticed regarding the building. Has much changed?
Amazing. My first reaction years ago was when you cut down the tree that we loved, big, beautifully, that you to extend the back of the place, you had to do that, and you got rid of our garage, and that's now a car park. We had a lovely fernery. That's gone. But you've built a bigger fernery, like where people can sit, so that's an advancement. Where my room was, there's now stairs going up there. That the stairs used to be somewhere totally different. So my room was right on the corner, overlooking the corner of the street, and Little Victoria Street, is it? Is that what it is? Yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
And Smith Street. And the main office that's in the office was right under my room where Lyndon and all the others used to meet, and he and Caroline were always there on their typewriters producing the education subscription service and the care newsletters and all that. They were always there. That now is the base for going up to the, you know, that's the reception and there's stairs going up there to what would have been my room.
Tell us about the soundproofing, because I found that
Right next to, right under the room next to me was, what do you call it? Egg cartons were tacked against all the walls so that even though I was almost right next to them, I could never hear any printing.
Never.
Never. I can't remember.
Egg cartons.
I can't remember any printing.
I think we need egg cartons.
It was amazing.
Could you make that down? Put it down, Henrietta. Egg cartons.
That makes sense.
It makes sense.
Because they've got this irregular and they're all that absorbent material. Yeah.
And last but not least, tell us about the fireplace and your dog.
Oh, yeah. The dog followed me home from Collingwood. And he's black and white, just coincidentally.
Right.
And from Cromwell Street, you guys, right?
It's our fault, obviously.
And I went across to Dallas Books Hall with him and went into some meeting there, and he was sitting outside. He got sick of waiting. He walked home across Victoria Parade Street and got hit by a car and dragged himself home eventually. And he spent 6 weeks sitting in front of the fireplace, not allowed to do anything till it healed.
Yeah.
And just when it was ready to do exercise, he cut the other foot like a godsend then he had to use the one I was supposed to make him use.
Right.
Yeah. So he had a slice off the foot and then he's got absolutely no limp for the rest of his life. He lived for 20 years. Partly because he ran with the horses and partly because I walked everywhere with him and partly because he had a fish head every week. I bought him a fish head. He loved it.
Right.
And he lived a ripe old age.
We need a plaque. We need a plaque over the fireplace because nobody uses
Joe.
Joe. J-O or J-O-E?
Well, they were starting to, I wanted to call him nothing like Foot Rot Flats.
All right.
And then Lyndon started calling him Bozo. Not Bozo. So I said, what about Joe? And they called him Jojo.
Jojo's
fine. That's what they were calling him here.
Well, thank you very much for coming into the studio. Yep. It's been a pleasure talking to you. I'm sure you've relived a lot of good memories. So Henrietta's going to take a photograph of you in the courtyard full of ferns, and we're going to podcast this so it'll be up for all eternity. Thank you very much.
Oh, thanks very much, Joe and Henrietta. Thanks for the chance to speak and be heard and to listen to your conversation as well.
Thank you.